Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Harvard scholar Randall Kennedy about his new book on the color line in America.
What would be a racially just society such that we'd say, okay, no one can reasonably complain? You know, what would shut my mouth, so to speak?
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Times columnist Genia Belafonte tells us about the exciting new book club she's starting at the paper.
The book has that nostalgia. It captures the sense of recklessness that dictated many lives in the 70s.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Randall Kennedy is professor of law at Harvard and one of the nation's most renowned and respected commentators on race, among other issues. He's got a new book. It's called The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. I'm delighted that Randall is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So a few years ago, our listeners will remember the beer summit that involved a quite good friend of mine, Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr., and a police officer in Cambridge, where you teach. And at that moment, it seemed as if race was going to be a dominant motif in America during the Obama years. Has that proved to be the case or not?
That has not proven to be the case. And one of the reasons that that has proven not to be the case is because the president has clearly wanted to steer away from racial issues as a major motif of his presidency. In that very episode, when the president made his critical remarks about the police officer who arrested Professor Gates in his own home, the president was very careful to say he was not accusing the police officer of engaging in racial discrimination. All the president said was that the police officer had acted stupidly. But even that prompted a firestorm of criticism, part of which accused the president of essentially being a sort of a reverse racist. And the president backed back. And ever since then, he's been very careful to steer clear of racial controversy.
Did you expect something different when he entered the White House? Civil rights was a theme in the campaign. That is, the civil rights movement is part of this long narrative that he told often during his speeches. Did you expect there would be more direct discussion of and kind of assessment of race in America in an Obama presidency?
No, I did not. It's true that he used the civil rights narrative during his presidency. I mean, you know, John Lewis was a very important person whom he kept close at hand.
And this was a great civil rights leader who'd also was a congressman.
That's right, Congressman John Lewis, the great hero of the campaign for voting rights, the man who was beaten, kneeling, praying at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. He was a great champion of Barack Obama's, and Barack Obama has a tremendous amount of respect and affection for him and made that clear. And Barack Obama knows his American history. He knows the history of the Civil Rights Revolution, and he will certainly use the iconography of the Civil Rights movement when it's suitable for him. But Barack Obama is president of a country in which, you know, the majority of voters are not black, are not people of color. Sure, he recognizes that he's a beneficiary of the civil rights revolution, but he did not present himself as a civil rights champion or as a champion for any discrete group. He wanted to be president of the United States, and I think that in framing the issues that were important to him, he framed them as a person who, you know, was thinking about the polity as a whole. So, no, I did not expect him to act, frankly, all that much differently in the way he's acted.
Now, let's get to the book, Persistence of the Color Line. Where does it persist and how?
The color line persists in every aspect of American life. whether we're talking about culture, whether we're talking about politics, whether we're talking about how people date, who people marry, it doesn't matter. The color line is all around us. Now, insofar as politics is concerned, the color line is still there. Barack Obama overcame his blackness to win the presidency. That he was able to overcome his blackness shows a remarkable change in American racial attitudes. If he had been running 75 years ago, there is no way in the world that he would have been the nominee of a major party, much less managed to win the presidency. So there's been a tremendous change in racial attitudes. Nonetheless, Barack Obama had to overcome his blackness in order to prevail.
Well, let's talk about some big institutions. Let's talk about yours.
Sure.
Harvard and mine. The New York Times will start with yours. Is there a color line at Harvard?
Yeah, there's a color line at Harvard, and it operates in funny ways. Sometimes the color line helps people of color, no question about it. I'm quite sure that in my career, I have been helped on more than one occasion by the fact that I'm a black American.
Helped in what sense?
Harvard Law School called me up to ask me whether I was interested in pursuing a career as a legal academic. That was not on my radar screen.
What were you doing?
I was a third-year law student at Yale Law School. I had gotten a very nice clerkship with Court of Appeals Judge J. Skelly Wright. I had a job lined up. I was going to work at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And on the last day that I was in my office at the Yale Law Journal, I get a call. Ring, ring, ring goes the phone. On the phone is James Vorenberg, the dean of Harvard Law School. And he says to me, "Have you ever thought about a career in legal academia?" I told him, "No, but I'm game to talk about it." He said, "Fine, come see us." And over the course of the next year, I went up to Harvard a number of times, and they really talked me into it.
When was this?
This was in 1984.
But you were an editor of the Yale Law Journal.
Well, and I was a good student. And they had read, I think, that one thing that was very helpful. I wrote for magazines. I had written a number of pieces for the New York Times Book Review. I had written pieces for the New Republic. I had written pieces for Harper. So they had read stuff that I had written. And I was a good student. And I'm sure that there were certain law professors who said nice things about me. But the fact of the matter is there were a bunch of other people who were on the editorial board of the Yale Law Journal, and they didn't get calls from the dean of Harvard
they
Law
didn't
School
get that phone call.
Asking,
okay,
you know, to come talk.
And what about now? Set aside your career. What about someone beginning academic life now, either as a promising student or possibly someone who'll be a law professor in another academic field? Is it still an advantage to be a person of color?
In many instances, absolutely. Sure, there are people all through legal academia who serve really as one of the things that they do is they serve as talent scouts. They have their eyes open. You have to bring something to the table. It's not as if, you know, you're going to get a job at a leading law school if you're not a really good student. But if you're a really good student and a person of color and you're interested in a job in legal academia, are there going to be people throughout legal academia who are going to give you an extra, you know, nudge, push, encouragement, counsel? Are they going to pick up the telephone and say, "Hey, I know this person over here. If he or she hasn't been on your radar screen, he or she ought to be." Is that still part of our landscape? Yes. I think that's perfectly fine. I think that's justifiable. And that's a way in which, coloredness helps. Is there a flip to that?
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, there's a flip to that, sure. I mean, and sometimes the flip is related to the story I just told, because let's suppose you pick up the telephone and, you know, you say so-and-so is really good and you're talking about so-and-so. Now, the person on the other end of the telephone sometimes, sort of an antenna of skepticism goes up, and there's a little bit of uncertainty. And sometimes people get so skeptical that the person who you've been pushing actually has to leap, you know, over a higher hurdle to get over the skepticism that the, you know, the specter of affirmative action, you know, sort of puts before us.
Okay, as not entirely an outsider, as you said, you've done a ton of writing for very prestigious publications, including this one. Mm-hmm. So look at the New York Times, and where, as a close observer who knows something about what we do, would you sense a color line? When the paper covers race or looks at issues involving race, do you sense that there's a color line of some kind here at the paper?
Quite clearly, there is more of a consciousness at the New York Times, as at most major institutions in American life. There's clearly a consciousness that wasn't there a quarter century ago. Now, here I'm speculating.
Well, this newspaper editorially opposed the sit-in strikes in the early 60s.
Did it?
Yeah. Well,
I'm surprised, actually.
Yeah, I don't think in a universal way, but there was concern, there was anxiety, or these young people pushing too hard
right.
or something, this kind of thing.
Well, clearly the New York Times over the past 20 years, I'd say, has at various levels asked the question, are we being attentive enough to communities of color? Are we, in terms of our coverage, in terms of who we get to write, in terms of our commentary? And as far as I'm concerned, for good, are there always going to be problems? Sure. Whenever you take any action, there are going to be reactions, there are going to be missteps, there are going to be problems. But the basic idea at this institution, at my institution, we've got this long history of, you know, an illicit racial hierarchy. We're going to have to take self-conscious steps to try to grapple with that, and that's to the good.
Now, we're talking about two institutions that some in America would say are classic instances of a kind of, what, East Coast liberal elitism mm-hmm. or something. When you look at the country now, this is a time of political turmoil, and there's a kind of insurgency coming from a very different part mm-hmm. of the population. Do you see a racial component in that?
Sure, and it's an ironic one. People often think of, you know, liberal institutions as the only institutions that have this consciousness that I just mentioned. But I don't think that's true. Who are some of the stars of the Republican Party? Mr. Steele, when he became the, you know, the head of the Republican National Committee, did his blackness have anything to do with it? Of course his blackness had something to do with it. Maybe they didn't say so, but they were tickled pink to have a black person out front in the age of Obama. It was quite clear. Among the Tea Party, you know, very conservative folk, are they very happy to have, you know, Alan West?
And he's one of their stars.
Absolutely. And they're very happy about it.
Yeah. You know, I've been rereading a great small classic of American politics that I had not read in 40 years, which is Joe McGinnis's book, The Selling of the President, about the 1968 campaign of Richard Nixon. And what Nixon did to advertise his campaign, he did not want to go in any unscripted setting, because television had kind of been his enemy in his earlier campaign history. So they set him up with a series of panels all across the country with six or seven people. And every single time there would be one African-American because you had to have that for what they called balance. You didn't want liberals and moderates to think that Nixon, also very fraught time, the late 1960s, political assassinations and, you know, disturbances in the cities and all the rest, that Nixon was not addressing the African-American community in some way. So he very carefully, he and Roger Ailes, who was one of his advisors, would find one African-American each time. So to some extent, that's kind of the case still, right?
Yes. Every president since Lyndon Johnson has had at least one black person in the cabinet. I mean, and frankly, I don't care who would become president. I don't care from what ideological perspective, whoever becomes president, and this will go on for, you know, a good long while, will have at least one.
Right. George Bush actually did a little better.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, both.
Yeah.
Both Bushes did better.
Both Bushes, right.
Is race part of our consciousness? Sure it is. How do we make it a good part of our consciousness, and how do we do useful things that will try to, you know, push us towards a society that we, you know, we want to have?
Oh, what's the answer?
Ah, next book. I don't have a real good answer for you. That is a book-worthy topic. What precisely does racial justice mean? What would be a racially just society such that we'd say, okay, no one can reasonably complain? You know, what would shut my mouth, so to speak? I'm struggling with that. I think that's a good subject next book.
Well, we can't wait to have you back to talk about that one. Thanks so much, Randall Kennedy.
Thank you.
Randall Kennedy, whose new book, The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, more rumblings in the world of Scientology.
There was a little bit of attention this week on Lawrence Wright's new book, not perhaps the kind that Knopf would like to see. This is the book based on a New Yorker article that Mr. Wright wrote about the Church of Scientology.
Very long article.
Very long article. And this week, on Wednesday morning, some Scientologists, members of the church, were standing outside of 4 Times Square, which is, of course, the Condé Nast headquarters where the New Yorker is based. And they were handing out pamphlets that looked like the New Yorker, but they were titled Freedom.
And so this is a protest, obviously. How is Knopf and Lawrence Wright, who's a great American journalist, responding to this, what do we call it, pressure from the Church of Scientology?
I don't think that Larry Wright has made any kind of response yet, and neither has Knopf. Knopf did say that they still intend to publish the book, and they still have a deal with him. However, they don't have a pub date. But in the meantime, there are a lot of these so-called pamphlets circulating around New York. On the cover of the pamphlet, it says, "The New Yorker, what a load of balderdash."
I have to say, Julie, here we are. We are involved in putting out newspaper herself. Have you actually seen this mock-up of the New Yorker that they've done?
I have. It doesn't really look like the New Yorker, but it looks like a good approximation of it. It's very thick, probably thicker than the average issue of the New Yorker these days. And inside, there are some details about the people who worked on the piece. The editor, David Remnick, of course, his picture is inside. They have named inside this pamphlet the fact checker on the article. Larry Wright is on the cover. They have also named, I think, the legal counsel and this whole team of people within the New Yorker who were involved in the article. And they also, inside this pamphlet, take issue with the fact that Larry Wright apparently negotiated this book deal with Knopf before the article was published.
So this is a real production they've put together. They mean business here.
It is. It's glossy. They have, you know, clearly went to great lengths to put it together.
Any idea how many copies? We probably don't know, right?
We don't know, but there's also a DVD insert with video.
It kind of sounds like a collector's item, no?
It does. I mean, it also sounds like the kind of thing that might intimidate other journalists from writing about the Church of Scientology. So I guess we'll find out if Knopf still intends to publish the book. So far, they say they're going to.
And Mr. Wright, you say, has not commented at all?
Not that I know of.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Something we like to do at The Times is get our readers involved. And when books are at the center of it, it gets even better. There's going to be a new book club at The Times, Junia Belafonte, who is the big city columnist for the Metropolitan section of the newspaper, is starting a new book club, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome, Junia.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so tell us what the concept of this book club is.
The book club came about because I'm starting this column, and I wanted to learn more about New York and read all the wonderful books that featured New York as a character. And I had the idea to start a book club and have the readers join me in my own education process, and we are going to read a different book, fiction, nonfiction, classic, obscure, a different book every 6 weeks that features New York centrally.
Okay, now, Junia, when you say we, you mean yourself as columnist. Are there other Times staff who are going to participate in this?
No, we will sometimes involve authors if they are living and do Q&As with them, but I will be hosting the book club. I will post an essay on the day the book club is going to happen, and then hopefully readers will comment and we'll have we will have a live online discussion. If you click on New York City Region section of the paper, you'll find a calendar with the days of the book club over the next couple of months.
Okay, so you're going to choose a book. And by the way, how are you going to choose it?
I am going to choose the book, and occasionally we will open it up and we will do a reader vote, and the readers will collectively choose a book. The first book that I've chosen, I didn't really even have to give it much thought. The column begins on September 18th. Obviously, we're in the midst of the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and I wanted to pick a book that had a 9/11 resonance, but was not explicitly about 9/11. And I chose Colin McCann's Let the Great World Spin, which is the winner of the 2009 National Book Award.
And will Colin McCann, who has been here and done the podcast, will he participate in any way?
Colin McCann has participated with a project the Culture section is doing, in which they are doing video interviews with artists whose work has been affected by 9/11. And we, in our online discussion, will link to that video.
Okay, Junia, Colin McCann's novel, prize-winning, a quite brilliant novel, superbly reviewed. It's interesting you should choose it because it's really almost a kind of historical novel about Manhattan. It's set a generation ago in the 1970s. So why choose that book now?
The book is set in 1974, and it revolves around the incident of Philippe Pettit's walk, high wire walk across the Twin Towers. It captures a moment that in many ways had the connection. The city had a feeling of connection that many of us felt in the wake of 9/11. The city was crime-ridden, troubled, suffering from poverty. But people saw in this moment a great moment of unity in the city. And the book is very hopeful. I mean, Colin McCann obviously sees the city that way in the wake of 9/11.
And his novel was written well after 9/11.
The novel was written way after 9/11, towards the end of the first decade of the millennium. And he looks at the way disparate people come together in the wake of this incident of Philippe Pettit's walk across the Twin Towers. And obviously, of course, it is set in the Twin Towers. And
which remains the single most powerful image that we have of 9/11.
Exactly.
Let me ask you something else, Junia. Okay, so you're going to begin your book club with an essay.
Yes.
And you're a columnist, and you've been a critic, very prominent critic at the newspaper. So when you write your first column about Colin McCann's novel, will it be presented in such a way that readers are then invited to respond to what you've written, respond to the novel itself, a combination of the two? How will you get people involved?
I hope to begin a real conversation with readers about this book and then all the subsequent books. And there are many things that I'm curious about in the novel, and I have many questions, and I would like to engage readers with those questions initially. I think the book was very interesting to me because many of us who grew up in and around New York in the 70s have a great, great nostalgia feeling for it, even though it was crime-ridden and you couldn't walk in Central Park at midnight, and it was, you know, in many ways terrible compared to what we have today where you can run out and get milk at 2 a.m. in most neighborhoods and not think twice about it. The book has that nostalgia. It captures the sense of recklessness that dictated many lives in the 70s, but it has a real passion and feeling for the city in that time before corporate chains, before the Disneyfication of Times Square, all of that. It really has a great affection for that. And I do too, and I in some way I'm on a journey to find out why.
Well, we look forward to your first column and for the inauguration of the book club. Every 6 weeks, there'll be a different novel. Is it always a work of fiction?
It will not always be a work of fiction. We are going to look at nonfiction books. We will, you know, also read classic books about New York. You know, we'll do some Edith Wharton and William Dean Howells and all that, too.
Thanks so much, Zinnia.
Thanks.
That's Zinnia Belafonte, big city columnist for the Metropolitan section of the New York Times. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
So what's new on the list this week?
Well, we've got a little bit of a role reversal. This week, the fiction list is sort of lacking in new titles. We do have one at the top. It is the latest from Kathy Reichs, sort of the force behind the TV show Bones. And this latest adventure featuring the forensic anthropologist Temperance Brennens is called Flesh and Bones. Mm. But over on the nonfiction side, we do have quite a lot of new books. J.C. Dugard is still on top with A Stolen Life. She is in her seventh week. But starting at number 7 in the middle of this, we've got a bunch of new stuff. Alexandra Fuller's latest memoir of her sort of dramatic African childhood enters at number 7. It is called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. And Julie Solomon's biography of Wendy Wasserstein, Wendy and the Lost Boys, review in our pages a couple weeks ago, enters at number 14. And then at number 10, we have another book about a horse. It is called The $80 Champion by Elizabeth Letts, and it is the story of Snowman, an extraordinary jumper and national celebrity. I wonder if he is going to give Seabiscuit a run for his money. Then at number 9, another thoroughbred, Rafael Nadal, enters with his autobiography. It is just called Rafa.
Just called Rafa. This guy, a fantastic tennis player. And as you know, you and I are both fans, but I've been going to the U.S. Open because I'm, amazingly enough, writing about it a little bit for the newspaper. Nadal, an extraordinary tennis player, but he hasn't lived all that much of a life. Is there tremendous interest in what he's done so far, which is win a lot of tennis tournaments?
Well, obviously, there's enough interest to get him on the list, but it doesn't sound like he is delivering anything close to what Andre Agassi, for example, delivered 2 years ago in his book.
Now, Open, his memoir, which I reviewed, is one of, I think, one of the best sports books ever written. John McEnroe had a memoir called, I think, You Can't Be Serious, right, based on the comments he made at Wimbledon 1 year. These were guys who'd lived lives. They were, actually, their careers were finished. Nadal is just peaking in his. And makes me very curious to know just how revealing he is at this juncture in his career.
Well, maybe he sort of jumped the gun here. He is, after all, only 25.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.